This is Judaism Unbound, episode 79, Burning Mensch. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here today with Joel Stanley. He is the Senior Director of House Programs for Moshe House, an organization we know and love here on the podcast. We interviewed the founder of Moshe House, David Siegelman, early on in our run. Previous to his work at Moshe House, Joel was the Director of Jewish Innovation for the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, which is actually a core part of the story of this whole Burning Man series. When I was out there at the Palo Alto JCC about a year ago and met Joel for the first time, he was getting all ready to head off to Burning Man, as were a number of other folks working at the JCC or involved with the JCC there. And that was one of the first experiences that I had understanding in a powerful way that something was going on with Burning Man that, in a sense, I wish would be going on with Judaism. Actually, it reminds me of when I got my first iPhone, and I remember showing it around to people. This was the very first iPhone when it just had come out, and I was having people play around with it, and everybody loved it and was amazed by it. And I would say, imagine if people felt this way about Judaism. And that's sort of the same experience that I had when I was introduced to Burning Man, and I said, what if people felt this way about Judaism? And so I'm really grateful to Joel for having put us on the trail of this. And Joel, it is really great to have you on Judaism Unbound. I know you've been a listener for a while, and we're really excited to finally have you on as a guest.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here.
I guess I wanted to just start with if you could just sort of give us a sense of your point of view on it, how you came to start going to Burning Man, what your experience has been, and how you reflect on it as a Jewish leader in that kind of way.
You know, it's really interesting because Judaism, being a religion and a culture which has at its heart these pilgrim festivals, and Burning Man still to me feels like a pilgrimage. And it did from the very first time I went, which was in 2002. So like many of these things, it was word of mouth in the first instance. A friend of mine from college, you know, I grew up in the UK, and a friend of mine from Oxford said, he wrote me a 3,000-word email. He'd spent the summer in California, and I'd never heard of Burning Man. And he said, I went to the desert, and I did all of these crazy things. There's a theme for Burning Man every year, and the theme was the seven ages of man, kind of Shakespearean. And he describes all of these experiences that he had, these immersive experiences, some rebirth where he was like dressed up as a baby and bounced around by nurses, and then like all kinds of other things. And it blew my mind reading the email. And then I knew I was going to be in California the following year. And interestingly enough, at that point, I went to a session at a Limud conference, so a, you know, Jewish learning conference, where some, you know, another Jewish guy had just been back from Burning Man and was showing all kinds of slides and talking about some of what we're talking about today, what we can learn in the Jewish community from Burning Man. And that just kind of confirmed, seeing the slides he was showing, hearing more about the experience, confirmed that I really wanted to go. I was going to have the opportunity, and this was something that I really wanted to seize on. And it became even more of a pilgrimage because I was going by myself. This was an adventure. My friend had trodden that path the year before by himself, and now I was going to get to kind of strike out into the desert, change my environment, go to something really fresh and unfamiliar. And I think that's something of Burning Man's mystique and charm for people. There's always a first time for someone, and it's so different to what Burning Man people call the default world, that there's a sense of adventure that we've lost from many, many other walks of life. And it's radical inclusivity is a real strength that some people, Burning Man is a whole lifestyle. You know, they live in, now I live in near Oakland, California, but there are a lot of people in Oakland, California who want to live a Burning Man lifestyle kind of every day of their lives. They'll maybe even consciously say, I don't want Burning Man to be different from the rest of my life. And there are others for whom it is a real escape, or, you know, if there's any negative connotations of escapism, it's really a chance to heighten and elevate and experience what I understand by the true meaning of a holiday, that a religious holiday is an opportunity to elevate ourselves and actually kind of become more truly ourselves, right? By letting go of some of the habits that we've fallen into. And I certainly felt like that the first time I went to Burning Man. I was encouraged to challenge some of the kind of conventions and perhaps boundaries that I just held as a default without really questioning them previously. And here was an opportunity to play with them.
Could you say a little bit more about your experience at Burning Man? That when you say that it's a place where you're able to explore your values and to have that holiday that actually makes you reflect on those key dimensions, like, I'm curious, like, what happens there that allows for that?
There's a great degree of play that happens there. You know, it's a place to explore all kinds of different identities. People take on a plier name, meaning like a name. You can have you just choose a nickname for when you're at Burning Man. The costumes that people bring, the way people dress, you know, these are all encouragements to step out of regular everyday identity and try on new things, be very experimental. And the first time I went, that was a real challenge to me because I looked around and I was asking myself, is everybody being genuine? And I spoke to somebody there who had been 10 times and made friends with him. And he said to me, it's an interesting question that I'm asking, is everybody genuine? And he encouraged me to stop asking if everybody was being genuine and see them as people who are playing, you know, in the same way that children play. There's a certain authenticity that can come out through play. And when I stopped asking that question of whether people were being genuine, I started to be able to have fun myself and instead to be saying, what kind of experience do I want to have? So there is a permissiveness with all that brings at Burning Man. And within that space, so many different things can happen. So there's a huge amount of creativity as well. If there's a project that I want to bring and give to other people, whether it's an art project that I want people to experience or a workshop that I want to give or a talk, or I want to bring a pushcart and give ice cream at 100 degree heat in the middle of the day. You know, people are going to receive that really well, and the limits are my imagination. So within that, all kinds of experiences can happen. And then, of course, there's a great physical challenge that takes place. It's in the desert. There is this high heat in the day. It's cold at night. We're camping. Everybody has to bring all of the food and drink for themselves for the week or get together with their friends to make sure that they're being really self-reliant. There can be great dust storms, and that can be trying. And so a lot of emotional, as well as it being physically trying, a lot of the people's emotional stuff comes out. I've always felt that I'm open to that. It's one of the reasons I go to Burning Man, is to be able to process what I'm going through in my life and to be able to see more where I need to do work on myself. So if I'm open to that and it comes up and I look around, there's also support for that exploration. I meet other people who are there for the same reasons. I can go to some workshops, whether they're, you know, spiritual or psychological in nature. And it tends to provide what I'm looking for, what I want to find. There is a certain kind of serendipity that takes place there with now 70,000 people. I think there were 30,000 when I first went. But with that amount of people, all being creative, all offering, all being generous, and those are part of the principles of Burning Man, the possibilities really are endless, and it tends to deliver what I'm looking for.
So you got me thinking a little bit. Way back when, we had Casper Terkheil and Angie Thurston from How We Gather on the show. And I feel like so much of what you're saying, and also what we explored last week with Ali Wollner and John Mitchell, brings us back to their context. Because what they were looking at, for those who didn't listen to that episode, is this idea that there are a large variety of, whether it's corporate contexts or organizational contexts that aren't corporate, et cetera, that are achieving sort of religious purposes or goals, sometimes consciously and sometimes not, but from which we actually may be able to learn a lot in our religious context, because it may actually be, I mean, maybe this is my claim and not theirs, it may actually be that some of those contexts are achieving the religious goals better than many of our religious contexts. And I think about Jewish contexts, and it's not to say that there is no place where that emotional growth and introspection comes to light like you just described. But it's hard for me to think of like a super popular circumstance where you would have many thousands of Jews or Jews and their loved ones in a shared space where the context is such that they are very likely to get to like deep emotional questions and issues with one another. And to me, that's a powerful thing that we should be trying to do. And so I guess on that front, I'm kind of curious, are there other things that Burning Man seems to nail religiously, like religious kinds of goals that when you walk into some Jewish context, you sort of don't find? Or on the flip side, are there Jewish contexts that actually are replicating things that Burning Man is doing that you'd want to talk about?
You know, I think that Burning Man is doing really well in those six themes. Well, let's say four of the themes that were talked about in How We Gather, the communities, I think those themes were community, personal transformation, social transformation, purpose finding, creativity, and accountability, you know, as characteristics of communities coming together and purposes. And I think, you know, maybe not in accountability. I don't know if Burning Man is about accountability, but certainly things like creativity and purpose finding and personal transformation, you know, that's why I go. In answer to some of your second question about what is there in the Jewish world, the Limud conferences in the UK, where Limud began, they have about 2,000 people. So it's not 70,000, but 2,000 people all coming together. Again, a large amount of creativity, because there's a huge number of different choices as to what learning can I do, what Jewish learning, with a very kind of broad definition of what Jewish learning might be. What can I do there? For example, you know, I found Burning Man partly through a session at Limud. And there also was, again, that kind of lack of judgment as to what like a legitimate Jewish path would look like, which I really appreciate. And has helped me in my Jewish journey. So I think that it's a pretty good comparison to Burning Man, but it tends to veer towards the intellectual much more. And I wouldn't say that some of the more, you know, the kind of more extreme, more open emotional experiences, spiritual emotional experiences that we were talking about before would necessarily come up in Limud. I do think that Burning Man nails a few things which have, which we could learn from in a religious context. So privileging the experiential over the prescribed. The way that people learn at Burning Man is to throw themselves into experiences, that the art is art that you can climb inside, that you can touch, that is going to have a real impact, and encourage this interactivity. And I'd also say that, you know, when it comes to ideology, there isn't a kind of prescription of Burning Man. There are these 10 principles. These are values of Burning Man. Things like, you know, radical inclusion, gifting, communal effort, radical self-expression. These are principles of Burning Man that have been defined and have grown out of the community. And there's a strength in being able to say what the values of the Burning Man community are. But what Burning Man means is not prescribed. You know, what is the man? What does the burning of the man mean? So, you know, at Burning Man, there's this 30, 40 foot structure at the center of the event. And on Saturday night, there's a ritual in which it's burned. And it's kind of the climactic ritual of the whole event. But what that ritual means is not defined. For some people, it's okay. They're seeing symbolically. It's like all the things, all the old things of their year that they want to let go of, and allowing the kind of phoenix of their new year to rise from the ashes. How it originated was in 1986. The founder of Burning Man, Larry Harvey, built a 8-foot effigy on Baker Beach in San Francisco, burned it, and a bunch of people came and gathered around and read some poems. It just attracted some kind of people who were on the beach, and they had a party and agreed to meet the following year. And there's all kinds of myths about what it meant back then. But it's not defined. And I feel like there's a kind of ideological openness and a willingness for people to be able to find their own meaning.
Something that feels to me, I mean, I haven't gone, so I don't know, but something that feels to me that is a part of what makes Burning Man special, it's very basic. It's that, so it relates to a few things I said before. It's outdoors, and it's extended time outdoors, and there's also, on some level, like a shared trauma of that outdoors with the heat, and you said there's dust storms and all that stuff. And certainly, Jewishly, we're good at shared trauma. I feel like we don't need that much work on that particular part of this, but I do think the outdoor piece and the extended time spent outdoors with people, I think that's part of why people rave about Jewish camp. And like, I think there's something about that that's hard to pin down exactly that seems to lead to exploration and beauty and just sort of positive emotional results. I'd love to hear a little bit more just about that side of things. I can envision and imagine people that have gone to this for many years, you know, remember in 2006 when there was, you know, that crazy dust storm and we had to hire, like, whatever it was.
Yeah, that's exactly
I feel
how
like
it
that's
is.
Another, like, I feel like that would be part of what's special. And I just have an inkling that is something we could use more of in the Jewish world too.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that we spend a lot of time in the Jewish world sat in not necessarily particularly attractive buildings. And we are very insulated from the natural world around us at those moments. And definitely, you know, going out to the desert, being able to see a dust storm start up in the distance and head towards us, and there's nothing we can do about it when we're there, you know, we're going to be in 60 mile an hour winds soon. And you better get into your tent and batten down, or go and meet your neighbors and have a beer, sheltering from the dust together. Or maybe you're going to be out in the middle of the desert and there's nothing that you can do, and, you know, put on your dust goggles, your dust mask and your goggles to protect yourself. And while it's no fun necessarily to be in a big dust storm, it is also being connected to the bigger forces of nature, feeling that wildness, and knowing that we can't control all of our environment. There's something bigger than us that, you know, that we're subject to. It's an amazing reminder. I think it's no surprise that some of the things that I'm most excited about in the Jewish world also are starting to tap into that. So many of my campmates at Burning Man are also involved in an organization called Wilderness Torah, which is based here in the Bay Area. And Wilderness Torah is all about bringing Judaism back to the wild spaces. It's bringing back to nature, earth-based Judaism. So for the big pilgrim festivals, they go, you know, it's Passover in the desert. Passover took place in the desert. Let's celebrate Passover by going out into the desert and camping and having an experience of the elements and community together outside.
I mean, that does open up sort of one question that I was going to ask, which is kind of like, as you see it, sort of what is the difference between folks who come to Burning Man and want to create a Jewish experience at Burning Man versus folks who are Jewish and may well be very involved in Jewish life outside of Burning Man, but who are not particularly looking to create a Jewish experience at Burning Man because they see it as, you know, like a holiday, like you said, you're, you know, sort of a vacation from Judaism, perhaps. And I'm wondering, do you encounter people in both of those groups, or do you actually find that a lot of the Jews who are sort of immersed in Jewish life outside of Burning Man actually do want to have that Jewish experience at Burning Man as well?
I think they do, and I wouldn't want to overstate it. I think that, you know, our camp, Milk and Honey, is probably the most Jewish camp at Burning Man, and part of our mission is to create a Jewish home at Burning Man, which actually focuses a lot on the Shabbat experience that we lay on, where 500 people eat Shabbat dinner with us in the desert and 700 people turn up to the Shabbat service. But you could wander into our camp, and aside from our name and speaking to some of us, it's also a very open, inclusive, and not necessarily Jewish space. The name change from Sukkot Shalom to Milk and Honey was a conscious decision to not put kind of front and center stage the Jewish aspect as much, in order that it's a really welcoming thing for everybody who wants to come, and that language isn't alienating in any way. And there are all kinds of other events that take place at the camp. So I've seen like massage events to music, to live music at the camp, and Dutch dance parties, welding workshops, like how to weld large pieces of metal together to make art. So half the camp isn't Jewish. So, you know, I don't really know anybody who goes out to Burning Man and says, I want to have a fully Jewish experience at Burning Man. I think like all of these, like anyone's identity that comes to Burning Man, there's a space for it and a home for it, and also a willingness to let it go at other times.
It's funny because in listening to this, you know, part of me for myself and also for, I'm sure, many listeners is thinking, okay, how do I make this relevant to me? Because, like, for example, I don't really like to be outside very much, much less in the middle of the desert. And so I can understand how, you know, that translates for the rest of the year, that a lot of people might get involved with Wilderness Torah. But, right, for me, that physicality of, you know, being at Burning Man or at Wilderness Torah events isn't what I'm looking for. You know, I'd like to know what's the indoor version of that. And I think that what's important to sort of start to pull out is also, and I'm sure that this is something that you have thought of over the years in your Jewish work, is, you know, what are the principles that we see in action here? And how might the Jewish world be different if it used those principles as core foundational dimensions of how we do our work? How do you take from the experiences that you've had at Burning Man and from the perspective that's given you and say, you know, here's how I'm doing my work? And I guess further, if you were advocating, if you were speaking to people who had the power, whether they were funders or other types of folks in the Jewish world who could sort of help nudge things along, you know, what is it that you feel that you've learned from all this that you would want to say, hey, we could do better if we were only doing X, Y, and Z?
You know, you asked me how I use this in my work, and I do work professionally for Moshe House now, but how I became involved in Moshe House was actually living in one, starting one in London, and being a resident. And I did that, like many of your guests previously on the show, because I had a need. I had my own need, and I wanted to meet it. You know, the Jewish community that I wanted didn't exist. And that was one that, you know, wasn't based around labels, you know, wasn't necessarily like attached to a denomination. It didn't live in an institution. That it was creative, connected to a sense of learning and the past, but willing to play with it, and that it was radically inclusive as well. I used to talk about a principle when I was a Moshe House resident, that we were a community with a strong center and a porous, like a circle with a strong center in the middle, and a porous or non-existent boundary on the edge of the circle. So we welcomed everybody in, and they could tell what we were about. And we were unashamed to talk about Jewish learning and Jewish principles, and traditions and rituals, but everybody was welcome. you know, often what happens is when people have a strong sense of their identity is then there are boundaries that go up and there's a sense of who can come in and who's not part of that. And we were very conscious about not doing that. And I actually thought about that. I think that in talking about that diagram, that circle, that shape, it's similar to ways that I've heard Larry Harvey, who founded Burning Man, talk about the shape of Burning Man. You know, Burning Man is in the camps are there in a, it's kind of a circle, but the top 60 degrees of the circle are cut out. So the city is facing outwards and it's open. And he says, you can't close the circle. So that radical inclusivity is something that we could definitely do better at. The creativity, which, you know, in Burning Man principles, they talk about radical self-expression. How often in the Jewish world does someone come up with an idea and then want to put it out there and get told that's not Jewish, or kind of get shamed for trying something that isn't appropriate in that space? Whereas I think in Burning Man, somebody tries something new or weird and everybody goes and applauds them about it. You know, like there's a guy, like you don't expect to see a guy in a suit at Burning Man, but you walk across the desert and somebody set up a full office out in the middle of the desert with a desk and a laptop and is there in a gray suit and a gray tie pretending to be, you know, stressed out at work. And that person's been really creative. Great. It belongs here.
I've been thinking a lot about some of these questions, for example, that come up in the intermarriage debate, where there's a claim that's kind of made that says all the demographic studies show that intermarriage leads to less Jewish affiliation. Well, that may be true of Judaism defined in a way that fundamentally doesn't approve of intermarriage. Well, of course, if you intermarry, you're likely to sort of drift away from that. The question becomes, if you become radically inclusive, then it probably also impacts the thing itself, right? And that, and if you are afraid of that or disapproving of that, and you say that change is a bad thing, then you would say, well, radical inclusivity is bad because it will lead to these deleterious changes. If you say, no, I actually think that change is needed, and in fact, the change that we need is one that would be enriched by radical inclusivity, then that's a different conversation. And so sometimes I wonder whether we're speaking at cross purposes to one another in the Jewish world, because actually we aren't necessarily disagreeing about the impact of certain things. We're more disagreeing about the desirability of that impact.
Totally. It's a choice to trust where radical inclusivity might take us. Change is, you know, you said, is change desirable? Change is also obviously inevitable. But are we willing to embrace the amount of change that comes with radical inclusivity? It reminds me of this very funny and amazing article that was written in the Burning Man Journal called A Brief History of Who Ruined Burning Man. And there's been a lot of press recently about, you know, Silicon Valley and the one percenters who can afford to go do Burning Man, maybe do Burning Man in a luxurious way, and how it's not what it used to be. And people have been saying Burning Man isn't what it used to be for its entire history. And in fact, this article, you know, starting in 1986, which was when Larry Harvey turned up on the beach with an effigy of someone and just invited people to come. In 1986, a crowd of complete strangers gathered around the man once it was lit on fire. Nobody had invited them. They didn't know about the 10 principles or understand what the man was about. They just saw something cool and wanted to participate. Strangers ruined Burning Man, right? And that changes. The person whoever ruined Burning Man changes. And I think it is actually in itself a radical decision to say, yes, things can get worse as well as get better, but that's worth the risk.
Let me ask you in terms of your thoughts about Moshe House, because I've always looked at Moshe House and seen great potential there, right? That what Moshe House is doing in a fundamental way is, for example, or could be, for example, moving the focus, moving the location of Jewish communal living from the synagogue or the JCC or some other large building to people's homes and living rooms. And that, like we were talking about in terms of radical inclusivity, right, that is the kind of move that has the potential to unleash great change, because it is actually a profound move. And I'm not sure whether or not that's sort of already happening in Moshe House, or whether it's something that you want to see happen, or something that at least you want to see happen if that's what the people want to do. But I'm curious if you could sort of talk a little bit about the landscape of Moshe House as a place of, let's say, you know, radical possibility in Judaism.
Of course, it's not just about a place, you know, a location question and moving Judaism into the home. It's also what comes along with that. Stepping out of the synagogue or even, say, a JCC, there's a certain amount of trust that is given to normal Jews, the young adults who are involved in Moshe House, the residents. Moshe House is also now doing or supporting peer-led retreats. So not even necessarily Moshe House residents, but just Jewish young adults who want to run, who get some training and then want to run a retreat. And they, whatever they can think of, whether there was a retreat recently I saw about Judaism and trees. And then this group spent 2 or 3 days on tree planting and spending time in the trees and looking at the significance of trees in Judaism. That was their passion and that's what they did. So I think that as a thread throughout all of Moshe House's work, which is both Moshe houses where young people live and put on events, and also retreats and all kinds of other projects that Moshe House is now involved in, is this idea of giving over the reins of Jewish life to the demographic themselves, not someone older or institutional saying, this is what you should do and this is what it looks like, because that's what's going to drive people away. Nobody wants that. But rather saying, here you go, we know you're passionate, we know you've got ideas, we know you know where your own shoe pinches and how to meet your own needs, how to do your own jobs. So we want to help you to do that. And when those reins are given over to young people, then amazing things happen.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the issue of those retreats and the question of handing over the reins. I think about this all the time as somebody who is on the younger end of Jewish life for sure. But I was actually thinking recently, because I was in an airport and somehow I gleaned that there's no way to prove this, but it felt to me like people were looking at me just like they would look at any adult male. And part of that is I have a beard, so I might look slightly older than I am. But I was realizing for the first time, and it was a little disconcerting to be honest, that like, oh, I just looked sort of like other adult men walking around. And it wasn't like a few years ago when I think people saw me and they thought, oh, okay, so he's probably a college student, some sort of young adult, quote unquote. But I was thinking about that because in the question of handing over the reins, it can be really important, because in every other element of our lives, we, and by we, I mean people in their 20s, certainly once we're in their 30s or 40s, which I can't fully speak to, Dan can better than I, but we feel fully empowered in the rest of our lives, but in the Jewish world, we're not fully. And one thing I've noticed about sort of peer-led situations where it's younger folks along with other younger folks is that the question of structure becomes very different. In Jewish settings that I'm a part of, the vast majority of the time, every moment is set up, you know, to a T. Even the breaks are scheduled for, you know, exactly 11 minutes or something. I mean, maybe not 11, but there are breaks that are scheduled, that are put in the day, that are, even those involve some amount of forethought and structure. And what I've noticed is often you go to these Jewish events and they're fine. They're sometimes even better than fine. But often the best parts are when the schedule ends and everybody's just hanging out. Maybe they break out some instruments and they're playing music with each other. Maybe they're just talking. Maybe they're whatever it is. But that's often the best part. And it seems to me that when we think about Burning Man, that that's also, and also these retreats, that maybe that's part of what's at play here, is that you're sort of supposed to not follow the schedule at Burning Man. I'm assuming there's some sort of schedule, but by the sound of it, you know, people are doing what they're doing and it's probably mostly not on the schedule. And that's okay. And not only is it okay, that's sort of built in. And I guess I'm trying to figure out, like, what does that show us or teach us for Jewish life? Can we integrate that on some level?
I think there is something to that. It's interesting that at Burning Man, we still can't get away from schedule altogether. There is a booklet right? There's like, you know, like the conference booklet for Burning Man. It's called The What, Where, When. And camps can submit their events that they're planning if they can get them in by a certain date. And then they'll be printed and you get it when you come into Burning Man. And it lists different places to go for different workshops or parties or, you know, dressing up as a bunny and marching through the desert. But I think that there are severe limitations to that schedule when it comes to Burning Man. First of all, it's only something like, they only have room for something like the first 1,000 events that are submitted, each with a very small description. And it therefore fills up a couple of hours after the event registration opens. So what the organizers of Burning Man say is you can do anything that you like. First of all, you can put it on this kind of schedule online, which people can check at any time. And you can tell us at Playa Info when you get to Burning Man what's happening and people can find out about it. But nobody really looks at that. Some people clutch their little what, where, when, and they decide that they're going to schedule their whole Burning Man. But like you say, the best stuff happens when it's the unexpected. And there's so much happening at any one time that if you're open to it, good things are going to happen. Good, unpredictable things are going to happen. There's definitely FOMO, fear of missing out at Burning Man. Like all of those things that I didn't get to. And I start to have a much better time when my regular, like I must be on a schedule and I must maximize the use of my time brain starts to relax after probably a good 48 hours. Burning Man is a week long. I want to go for the whole week because it takes me 48 hours to get out of my schedule brain and get in a mind state which is really open to all of these amazing things happening. I actually think in the Jewish world and maybe in the outside world, part of it is we don't have things which are necessarily like big enough with as much happening to get away from the schedule. You can't schedule Burning Man because there's so much there and there's so much happening. I go to Limud conference with 2,000 people. I can schedule most of it. I can capture most of what's happening, although there's still the margins. Unless you think of like the event as your city, you know, a city like, what's a great attraction of a city like New York or London? There's just so much happening. You can't ever know the whole city or encapsulate the whole city.
Well, a related question that goes back to when you were talking about sort of the empowerment of Moshe House, but I think it's also true of the empowerment at Burning Man, is if you're sort of, let's call it a policy maker, but I don't think that's the right word. It's like a policy nudger, right? Somebody who's trying to affect things in a positive way. How do you look at the sort of world of sort of empowered lay personship, right? Just by pushing the responsibility for creation to the people at the ground level. And how do you balance that with a kind of, but maybe they don't yet know enough information to really do a great job, right? And it's not a great job judged by me. It's a great job judged by others, right? Maybe what they're doing isn't going to be successful, but not because their idea wasn't a great one, but just because it wasn't sufficiently enriched by the stuff that Judaism has already developed or the stuff that has happened at Burning Man 3 years ago, but they didn't know about, you know? And so how do we balance this kind of desire to empower people at the grassroots, but not sort of veer into a sort of know-nothingist sort of leadership model that, you know, I think we see going on at certain levels of our government.
I want to say about Burning Man, anybody can do anything and, you know, bring their project, but they're not necessarily being funded by Burning Man for it. If you're willing to fund yourself, you can do anything that you like and ask people to come in and experience it. And if it's a good experience, maybe they're going to help you out next time. But, you know, it worked. And you can do that. And we can do that in the Jewish world as well. I think we have this reliance on a funding model where we're looking to philanthropists and foundations and saying, you know, come and fund what I do. If I'm doing something reasonably cheaply, or I can find the means or find a model to get funding in other ways, then no one's stopping me from experimenting as much as I like, right? And we should be clear about Burning Man. Actually, the Burning Man organization, Burning Man Org, gives art grants for their big artists or for artists to come out and create exciting projects. And yeah, it has an application process, and that artist probably has to show that their project is going to work and they've got the credentials to do so. So I think the funding, the attachment of funding, has a lot to do with that. We've definitely thought about it in Moisha House. We found that we had residents who were putting on programs around the holidays, turning their homes into centers of community, and then feeding back to us that they wanted more knowledge, that they felt themselves that they weren't empowered enough because there were gaps, and their community, they suddenly found themselves community leaders, but they wanted to know more. And that's actually how the Moisha House Retreats program came into existence. Like, Moisha House Retreats, run by the organization, bringing in outside educators, were seen first of all as trainings for community builders, for peer-led community builders, to learn more. And the style of education is very open and non-prescriptive ideologically, but trying to give the background and the information and the experience necessary for them to then go out into their community and say, all right, I can do this. I now know what I'm doing. So we're really open to people's creativity and for people's willingness to go and do things, and then willing to say to our funders, look, invest in us so that we can pair those people up with the experts out there who can give them what they need to bring their creativity and motivation to life.
So Joel, you listened to our podcast enough to know that the way we like to wrap up is just by asking our guests, is there anything else that is pressing for you that you'd like to communicate to a bunch of your friends out there listening? Anything on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to say that I know kind of I was the main topic of our conversation today was about Burning Man. It's been said numerous times that Burning Man is not for everybody, and I wouldn't claim that it's this like panacea which is going to solve everybody's problems. I'm really interested in what we can learn from experiences like Burning Man, and it could be anything out there really, which inspire passion and inspire community, and for us to be open in the Jewish world to bringing those ideas and those experiences back in to enrich what we do.
Well, thanks so much, Joel Stanley, for joining us for this episode.
Thanks so much. It's so great being here.
As a reminder to all of you out there listening, we would love to be in touch with you if you have any thoughts, questions, concerns, ideas related to this episode or any of our past ones. And you can be in touch with us in a few ways. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us financially with a one-time gift or a monthly recurring donation. And you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.